This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. Many Australians joined the Royal Australian Air Force and found themselves in England as crew with the Royal Air Force planes in many roles and on many missions. I do have a note of your date of birth, which is 1923, but what day and what month?
17th of June.
So that means you were smack bang at the beginning of the Great Depression.
Yes.
You were the second son of four sons.
That's right.
That was hard yakka for your parents.
It was hard work for them.
But one of the good things that appeared to me reading your book is that you were a great make-do-and-mend family, and that if there's something you wanted to do, you found the way to do it. And I believe at the age of 13, you made a crystal set.
Correct.
Now that, for the listeners, is not a set of drinking glasses. What is it?
Well, it's a method of receiving radio or wireless in those days. We only had three stations in Adelaide then, and they were easily picked up on a crystal set. I made my crystal set out of a matchbox.
Really?
Yes, and it was my own idea to change the channels. I just pulled the matchbox in and out, and I was able to get the three channels one at a time. Thought of that myself.
That's amazing. You obviously do have a skill, a talent, an unlearned talent. That's great. And I also understand that your father insisted that you learn Morse code.
At an early age.
Yes. What age was it?
About 13 or 14.
I look at it and it blurs in front of my eyes.
Well, Dad had four sons, and we all used to send Morse code at the table with a knife and a fork in that way, clicking like that. Mum could not understand it, but we could all talk to one another in it.
That would drive your mother absolutely mad.
Oh, she was a wonderful lady. Had to be to put up with us, the four boys.
You obviously did all the things that boys do when you were growing up with your brothers, and I imagine that some of them are unprintable.
Well, my younger brother and I used to work out all the naughty things, and the older one would say, no, you mustn't do that, Mum wouldn't like it.
But the Ballarat Baptist Church still managed to give you a small Bible.
Correct, which I used on my raids in my pocket. And that was for two purposes. Mainly if I was shot down over Germany, I had a book to read. I couldn't read German. And secondly, that if a piece of shrapnel came towards my heart, the Bible was there. But fortunately, we were shot at every raid, but it didn't go through my heart or towards my heart.
I have heard of a lot of airmen putting a cigarette case in that pocket for that reason, but you didn't smoke, did you?
I didn't. Never smoked, no.
And you didn't drink?
I didn't drink, no, not all of it. I didn't drink until I was about 30, mainly because I didn't want to. It was my beliefs, so I didn't believe in alcohol. And I tried to be Christian all my life. It wasn't easy in the Air Force. I didn't know anybody else that was like me. I was so different. The aircrew used to go out after raids, come back and get plastered with alcohol. And I just sat in our cabin, or our Nissen hut, which I was pleased to be on my own. And I wrote letters to my wife, my fiancée then, and my mum and dad and all my relatives and friends with whom I stayed in America and England. Because the English were very kind to us. They invited us into their homes because we had nowhere, we were lost, and they were very kind to us. As long as we took our ration tickets, they were happy. The squadron was 149, and that's the one where the first Australian VC was awarded. A chap in about 1941, I wasn't even in the Air Force then, he flew Stirling, into Italy. And on the way back, he was damaged. He could hardly see. And the plane was shot up. And he eventually got back to England. and he asked the crew to bail out over East Anglia. Two refused to go, so the three of them continued on with the plane and the others jumped out. They never found the plane, never found the bodies. So he was awarded the VC for that. So I said that what I want is to get the RSL badge. It's a bit of a joke, you see. If we got that, we'd come back.
Can I take you back to how this path started? That after school, you did a lot of electrical repair jobs when you were working for Lawrence and Hanson.
Correct.
So you added that to your Morse code.
Yes.
Now, I believe that in 1941, when Pearl Harbor was bombed, you rushed off and enlisted.
So did thousands of air crew chaps.
Why did you choose the Air Force?
Well, there was a reason for that. My Christian beliefs led me to believe I couldn't shoot anybody. But being up in a bomber plane, I wouldn't know what was going on. That helped me no end with my beliefs. I probably killed a lot of people, but that I couldn't help that.
Yes, I do. I believe it must be very disturbing to think that you were, in fact, killing women and children as well as soldiers. But you managed to reconcile that. I believe you attended the trial of a conscientious objector.
At Tail and Bend,
and you saw things through different eyes when you did
that. Yes, I did, because it took a lot of courage to stand up in court and say you wouldn't fight for your country. I was already in the Air Force then, home on leave at Tail and Bend, where Dad was the postmaster.
Now, you started your training under the Empire Air Training Scheme, which was a British government initiative.
That's right, yes.
But you wanted to be a pilot, but because you did good Morse code and were good electrically, they decided, no, you couldn't be a pilot. They wanted you to be a wireless operator air gunner.
Correct, yes.
So you then went to start all this training to Victor Harbour.
Yes.
Tell me about your culinary delights of your first meal at Victor Harbour.
The first meal, we all lined up, and the food was put in a bucket, a huge tub about 2 feet across, and they used a big shovel to put a whop onto the plate. And when we sat down, the orderly officer came round. Any complaints? I said, yes, sir. What's the matter? I said, I got maggots in my meat. He said, go back and get another lot, which I did, and that was all right.
Well, that was disgusting.
Well, it was all part of life.
So, Doug, you applied yourself to your training and you finished second in your class.
Correct, yes.
But you missed out on a commission. How come?
Well, the commanding officer was a racing man and he had a lot of racehorses, Wing Commander Fairburn. And so he said to me, oh, you come from Tail and Bend. I said, I've never been there, but Dad's the postmaster. He said, they've got a race course there. I said, sir, I'm not interested in racing. That cost me the commission.
This was again because of your Christian beliefs.
That's right.
Your Christian beliefs certainly gave you a lot of hurdles to overcome
it did.
Along the way.
Yeah.
Good for you.
There's only one case in my life where I saw a man at night time in a hut kneeling at the side of the bed praying, and no one said anything. There were 24 of us in a hut, Nissen hut, in Ballarat. And I thought, what a brave man. I mean, much as I would like to have done it, I didn't. But I went to church at every available opportunity when they took us into Ballarat, and that's where I got the Bible.
I understand
that. They asked me, would you like to come out the front? Yes. Have you got a Bible? I said, no. Well, here's one. Thank you.
Do you still have it?
I still got it, yes.
What a treasure.
Well, it's only about that big, but it's got both testaments in it, the old and the new one. I could read it then, but now I can't even read it with the glasses on.
Your air gunner's course was in Sale, Victoria.
Yes, that's right.
You didn't really get an awfully good record there, did you?
3%. And the reason being, they said, well, we can't fail because we need you. So the next thing we went finished up in America.
But you had the skills they needed, didn't you?
Oh, yes.
You had
more skills. Well, I never fired a gun in the Air Force.
But you were in the bombers, so knew what was going on. Yes,
oh, yes.
Now, you were posted overseas in November 1943 to San Francisco.
Correct, on a ship.
You'd like to talk about that ship?
It was an American ship called the Lurline, which was a Matson Line shipping. And it was a beautiful ship. It was only about 25,000 tonnes, a bit different to the ones that Laurel and I have used since. And we had to do, they expected the air crew, there were a lot of soldiers on there from England, going back to England after 9 years in India. And they said, you've got air crew, there's 114 of you, how's that from memory? He said, you've got to do 2 hours on watching for submarines and 6 hours off. And that ship, where they then said, you go down, have a meal, well, it was like a hotel. It was an American ship. And they gave their troops the best of food. It was wonderful. That was 17 days, I think, from memory, of wonderful food. I never had food like that again, especially in other places, except in England, where when we did raids, we got the best food England had, because a lot of us didn't come back, so they had to give us something good.
And you had been through the Great Depression, so food was not plentiful then either.
With four sons and Dad only on a meagre salary, we didn't have much to eat.
But it set the pattern for a very slim figure of a man for the rest of your life.
That's right, yeah, so I never put any weight on since I was 18.
You spent some time in New York waiting for your next ship to the UK.
Yes.
You tell me about that time, because I understand you were able to follow some of your real loves like music.
Correct, yes. I went to the Metropolitan Opera to hear an opera that I'd never heard before, Rigoletto by Verdi. And they were the best singers in the world in it. And I can remember some of their names. Once Ezio Pinza, Lily Pons, Charles Corman, and another man. I had to stand up for 3 hours, but it didn't cost me anything. Anyway, I had a lovely time there. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Just transported you.
Yeah, then I went to the Carnegie Hall, and that wonderful performance there. Wow, couldn't believe it. It was all free because I got tickets given to me when I was in the Air Force. By the one thing, I had no money. $1 a day didn't even cover one meal. We got accommodation for 10 cents a night in the Salvation Army. And that's where we slept. A lot of us had. We had no money. So walking down 6th Avenue, I saw a shop there, a bookshop. It says, Servicemen, welcome. So I went in. Oh, what do you want, Aussie? Because we had Australia up here. I said, any chance of a job? And he said, why? I said, I haven't got any money. He said, you sign this receipt and they'll give you $20. I said, I don't want that sort of money. I want to work for it. He said, when can you start? I said, now. He said, well, will $1 an hour be all right? I said, yes, that's good. Instead of $1 a day. And that was a wonderful experience for me to go to the bookshops and go and visit the places. I went to a place called Stephen Clark, I think his name, a wealthy man. And he had these wonderful paintings. As I walked into his, I knocked on the door and the butler came out. He said, oh, come in, Aussie, because they rang him. Phoned him, he said, oh, I was coming. So I went in, he said, what do you got? I said, some books for Mr. Clark. He said, oh, come in. And I'm walking in this passageway, it was nearly half the width of this, and there's these pretty paintings, Van Gogh and all the great artists that I'd heard about but never seen them before. When he came back, he said, here's a silver dollar, Aussie. And I said, wow, that's the tip. And I said, are they original? Of course they are. Now, you wouldn't believe it. Laurel and I went there to the Metropolitan Museum of Art about 20 years ago. And there's his name up there, Stephen Clark, whatever it was. We're going there. It's all these same paintings as I saw. So he gave the lot to the art gallery there. And, he had a lot of money. So that was something that I...
Amazing experience, yes, yeah. Yes. Now, you eventually did get the next ship to the UK. Tell us about that ship.
Oh, it was terrible. that was due to be scrapped in 1939. It was Samaria, which is in the Bible, but they couldn't scrap it. It was only designed for 600 passengers, but they put 7,500 troops on it. The Americans had to sleep up and down the staircase. Can you imagine sleeping on a staircase like that? And then the alleyways. And we had about 16 to a cabin that was supposed to have two in it. At least we had somewhere to sleep. And there was only two meals a day. It took 4 hours to eat. And because I think I mentioned in my book that I had nothing to eat. And I got hungry and I said to one of the sailors on board, I said, is there a cafe on the board? He said, cut it out, it's a warship. I said, oh. He said, why? I said, I'm hungry. He said, follow me. Well, that was the beginning of my first lot of smuggling. He said to me, after 3-4 days, you got any room in your kit bag? They call them kit bags. This canvas ones. I said, plenty. I picked one up in New York and it's empty. So he said, how many can you get in? I said, let's try it. Well, then I said, we have got to put socks around it and underwear, which we did. And I must have been 20, 30 cartons in there. They only allowed one carton each. So I gave him his mum's address in Liverpool and the money to get there. And off I went. And he was there waiting. I gave him to him. That's the only time I smuggled in my life. And I reckon it was justified.
Well, yes, you were hungry, weren't you?
I was hungry, yeah. I wasn't the only one that got the food.
So eventually, after this nightmare journey...
It was terrible, yeah.
You arrived in the UK.
In Liverpool.
In Liverpool, which is not exactly the beautiful capital of the country.
No.
And you were stationed in 13 different places around England.
Yes.
Because there were 155 Bomber Command airfields.
You got the figures right, haven't you?
Well, I was brought up in, it was called Huntingdon, that county then. Yeah. It's now been merged with Cambridge. And the airfields that I cycled to and around were Upwood, Brampton, which was American, and Witten. They were all arable land which had been made over into airfields.
Yeah, that's right.
So I was quite used to these ugly big bombers.
Yes, what an experience to think you've been through it.
Well, not really, but only the aftermath,
the
war itself.
You wouldn't be old enough for that.
Thank you. So you continued your training in Wellingtons, but not in Lancasters, because they weren't going to let you have Lancasters to get your hands
but
on.
But before that, they put us on other smaller aircraft, and that there's the photos are in my book, and I can't remember them all now.
No. And that training really set you up?
Oh, it was important, because they had to do flights for navigation and for radio contact, for wireless contact, because we didn't have very good radios. Well, they were good radios, the best they had.
You had the opportunity while you were in England of visiting London. What did you think of London?
Well, the worst part was trying to get there by the underground, and the smell in there was awful because people slept in there overnight for the bombing raids, and that the air conditioning wasn't too good. It's a wonder I didn't get sick, but I didn't. I was tough as boot leather in those days, and I was okay. And then I stayed in London where I could for cheap, just because I had no money. I had a bit more there because I wasn't spending it on the squadron. They put it in our pay book. And when we wanted some, they would give us some, you see. Paid by women air crew officers. Well, they were presuming they were air crew, I don't know. So it's the first experience of seeing women officers. We had to salute them and we got the pay. I didn't mind that as long as I got the money.
You had your priorities worked out. What about looking at all the bomb damage in London?
Oh, it was a shock. Yeah.
The first time you'd seen anything really ravaged.
That's right, that was an eye-opener. Well, that goaded me on, if that's the word, that I felt like bombing Germany then, for what they did there. And I thought, gee, if they can do that to us, we can do it to them.
I think you probably managed to reconcile some of your rather disturbed thoughts
Big eye-opener.
I don't suppose up until then you really had much concept within you of the dangers that lay ahead of
you. When we were at Brighton, that was the first place we visited after Liverpool. They said there's buzz bombs. V1, that's the ones that had went level, and then engine would cut out. Well, that was not very nice listening to them, but they didn't drop near us a fair way away. So that was thankfully very good.
But then you witnessed extraordinarily disturbing event when one of the aircraft didn't manage to take off, burst into flames, and the whole crew was...
They were all Australians on there. And that upset me, and I thought, gee. And I can't remember when it was, but I know they were about to take off, and then, boom, they all went off. So they had to clear away the garbage, and then we took off.
So you had to deal with that?
Yeah, that was a big shock.
Would you please take us through the sequence of events when an operation was called?
Well, we were in the mess, having something to eat, and they said, there's ops on now, so you can't use the phone. Where we go, we won't tell you till you get to the briefing room. They had the best food, good stuff, that I didn't realise it was there in England. But then I suppose a lot of us wouldn't come back anyway, so they had to feed us up a bit. Then the... I've lost the...
You're in the briefing room with the crews.
There will be 25 lots of crew in there, multiplied by 7. And we had 28 planes on the squadron. They had to have 25 airborne. So just before we're taking off, they would tell us where the target was. There were a lot not too happy about that. I was fortunate. The furthest one was Regensburg in Bavaria. That was about a 9-hour flight, and that wasn't very pleasant. I didn't like that. Still, didn't like any of them. Had to do it.
A 9-hour flight, so right. Yeah. That immediately makes me think, what were the toilet facilities aboard?
Oh, pretty good. We had a bucket with a lid on it.
A tight lid?
Yeah, it's just a bucket, you know, like that. But it was all right, what we did. They said, right, the first thing, before you get on the plane, there's a toilet, use it. So that was mainly... I didn't drink anything when I was on the plane. We had water to drink, but I wouldn't. I knew I would have to use the toilet. You know?
Probably got thoroughly dehydrated, but you made up
for that. Oh, I didn't mind that. The weather. It was cold where we were, especially up in the air. They're freezing.
7 crew members.
Yeah.
What was the duty of each man?
The first one was a pilot. Then was a flight engineer who was qualified to fly. He watched all the controls. And then in front of him was the bomb aimer. And coming back was the navigator. I'm next to the navigator, the wireless air gunner. Then there was a mid-upper gunner and a rear gunner. I don't know whether that's 7 or not, but I think it is.
Probably is, yes.
Yeah.
Now, the one that drew the short straw was in the rear gunner.
Oh, yeah, that was terrible, because he was the only one that could not have access to his parachute. The parachute was outside of the turret. There was not room in there. The parachute was about that wide, that deep, and about that high. I sat on mine. That was my cushion.
It was like a small cushion.
Yeah, and it was always on with the straps around. So if we were shot down, I'd have mine on. And the poor fellow at the back, who didn't have any hope, he had to turn around and then put his chute on. By that time, it was too late. So that's why the rear gunner had a short fuse on his life.
So between ops, you would have some time on your hands.
Yes.
And obviously, you didn't drink, you didn't go to the local pub and so on. You wrote letters home, which was lovely.
Yeah.
You weren't able to exercise your love of music, presumably. There wasn't a piano or anything.
No, but there was something. We used to get visitors from various string quartets. Grilla was one of them. And I can't remember all the others. And singers and pianists. So we had a place there where they had a piano, etc. So that was always popular, the music. and purely all classical, thank goodness, because that's my love, our love.
And you developed, if you'll excuse the pun, a skill in photography.
Yes, I took my camera with me and the chemicals and a little gadget like that into which I would put the film and the paper, and after I processed it, the next day I would do all this. And under the hut, in the Nissen hut, we had tables, little bits much bigger than this, and I used to put the blankets over there so I could do it in the dark, you see. So the crew would be very quiet, and so I did, because I used to give all the crew the photos. Thank goodness I did, because I had a fire in 1970 when my first wife was alive, and I lost all my photos, and that was a terrible thing. However, I used to write to the relatives overseas and some of the other friends, and they used to give them to me. So I started up a bit of an album. It wasn't like it was, because I used to take my camera on raids over Germany. I had some good shots too. But
that was the next step on your criminal career, was it not?
That's right, yeah. Well, no one said anything, but they were very happy to get a copy, I can tell you.
I think it's what you can get away with, Doug, isn't it? Mm. Doug, you have touched on some pretty horrifying experiences, and I understand from how you're describing it that there was a constant apprehension, a constant state of fear that all these young men, and yourself included, were living under.
Yeah.
Do you believe that there was any long-lasting emotional or psychological result of all of that?
I finished up with PTSD.
Did you?
I wasn't the only one, but I didn't know what it was in those days. It was only the last 20 years or so that we started to talk about it, and I got tests done, and I was able to get a small pension for it, you see. But now they don't have to pay much out because I'm one of the few left. It didn't cost them much.
That's more consolation, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's right.
One of the things our listeners will be interested in is how letters were transmitted
Well, what they had was about A4 paper with lines across it, and we then just put our squadron number on there, and I'd write an email letter, equivalent of an email, and they would photograph them onto a reel. So they got hundreds on there, and they would send the reel to Australia via America or some other place. I don't know how they did it. Then they would print them out and send them to the addresses. So that was the way we sent our mail.
It wasn't exactly private, though, was it?
Oh, it didn't make any difference. I mean, every letter was censored anyway. No, it was all right. I didn't care as long as I got one through. No postage. Now, my father smokes cigarettes, and we could buy a carton of cigarettes for 3 shillings and 6pence.
3 shillings and 6pence equates to 35 cents. But of course, in those days, 3 shillings and 6pence would be equivalent to around 13 English pounds, or approximately 26 Australian dollars in today's money.
So once a month, that's all I could afford, and I sent them home to my dad. And the postage was very little, and he eventually finished up with lung cancer. So I didn't know at the time.
Of course not. Nobody did. So just before the end of war was acknowledged or declared, your squadron was required to drop supplies into Holland.
Oh, Holland, yeah. Wonderful squadron. Well, we didn't know. The Germans said they wouldn't shoot us, so we came in about 500 feet. We could see them down. I could see them down there, because I got down the back of the plane and watched it all as I came. Took shots of them too. They're all gone. And there, as we came to the centre of Rotterdam, I think, the people, the planes, the pathfinders came in and dropped flares there, and then the pilot would drop the tons. They had about 7 tons of food on each plane. And they dropped 7,000 tons of food in Holland. Now, one of the ladies in our apartments here, I knew she came from Holland because she had an accent, and she told me, I said, did you get them? She said, I'll say we did. And did you get any? She said, yeah, we just helped ourselves. The Germans taken us, said they had to. They had nothing left. So that we got plenty to eat, and so we were very happy. I said, did you see me up there? She said, yes, I waved. Lovely lady, she is, yeah.
But then when the war was declared over, you had a very difficult sortie to do. That was to go and collect repatriated POWs.
Yes, and we went to a place out of Reims called Juvencourt. And I've been reading a lot of stories about aircrew and bombing command. That's all I read. I love reading about what the aircrew went through. And so at Juvencourt, we landed, and there were about 50 English soldiers that had been there waiting, and we took them back to England. And when they got off the plane, some of them kissed the carmat. They didn't think they'd ever see it again. I'm glad I wasn't a POW. It was bad enough what we went through, but they went through a terrible time.
I'm Fiona White, and I'm chatting with Australian World War II Bomber Squadron veteran Doug Leek. This was, well, not an unpleasant one, but a disturbing one for you,
yes,
seeing the prisoners of war.
Yeah, it was. And they were very thin. I could see the people. They weren't too good. They were lucky to get back to England where they got good food again.
So you returned to Australia and you resumed what could be called a normal life.
Yes, I was in the government, in the post office. Dad said, you've been appointed as a postal clerk at Saddleworth, which is about 100 miles north of Adelaide, I think. And I got married straight away within 4 weeks. My fiancée waited for me, and we had 32 years together before she died. And I never thought I'd meet someone like Laurel to put up with me.
You never know what's around the corner, do you?
No, that's right, yeah.
And particularly, you didn't know until November 2015 that François Hollande, who was
that's
president
right.
of France,
oh, my God, me, I...
he had awarded you the Légion d'honneur,
oh, no.
which is the highest possible bravery medal that can be awarded.
Well, there weren't many of us left to get it.
That was the commemoration of the D-Day landings, was it not?
Yeah, those that helped drive the Germans out of France.
Yes, that was 70 years ago.
Yeah, all we did was drop bombs on them, that's all the Germans. But they considered that to be... I had to produce evidence that I did bombing raids, and my name, dates of birth, everything. And so that went over to Canberra, and then they agreed to give us this medal. Oh, I was very... honoured. That was great, great honour for me to get that medal.
It was presented to you in the town hall.
That's right.
On the 1st of March 2016. Tell me how you felt.
I think it was the greatest thing outside of bombing Germany. It was great for me.
I would love to see the Légion d'honneur. It looks so pretty.
Yeah, Laura's
got very pretty.
Got all my medals out on to show you.
Yeah. It is one of the most beautiful medals I have ever
seen. I know.
Yeah.
And when I couldn't believe my eyes when they were giving... And the minister from France, who was the... what kind of minister was he? Defence.
Minister for Defence, yes.
Yeah, and each one of us, he kisses on the side of the cheeks, and I said, merci beaucoup.
Oh,
that's all
très bien,
French
très
on you.
Très bien.
I had to learn that one. Isn't it lovely?
That is. Oh, I can't put it down. I must put it down.
Yeah. And I've got a sheet of paper there that tells you what all these medals
are.
What
they all
are. But the one on the right is pretty rare.
Is it?
Yeah. That's only for Bomber Command.
That one.
That
this
was,
says Bomber Command here. This is for Bomber
Command. Yeah, that's the clasp for the Bomber Command. And this one here was the RAF. And it's got Bomber Command on it. That was a clasp given for those that flew on Bomber Command.
Mm-hmm. It's a fairly impressive row you've got there. Doug, on behalf of Service Voices, I would like to offer you my very grateful thanks for a lovely conversation, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and I know our listeners will love it. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's a real pleasure.